I want to start today by just recalling a little bit about what we did the week before about the BV complex and antifields and how they impose the equations of motion. And then I want to move on to look at the BRST complex, which will impose gauge invariance in a homological way. Suppose B is a vector space, or indeed a manifold, algebraic variety. And polynomial function. The BV complex, defined if we take xi, the coordinates on V, we introduce the polynomial ring as xi, but also some new guys, psi I, right? Psi I are of degree minus one. They're fermionic, so they're anti-commuting. And the differential is at the classical level it's this. So I differentiate my action, and that's just a function of the x's, and I put that next to the operator of differentiating with like this fermionic variable. And what this does, the image of this is, you know, things like that. So the cohomology of this, at least shape zero, will produce for you functions on the critical locus of S. Then there's a quantum correction. Which is an order two differential operator. And we saw last time that we can interpret this whole thing as being divergence for the functional measure. H0 of this is classically functions on the critical locus and the quantum level it's functions on V modulo divergence where we use the functional measure. So because of this, at the quantum level, it really captures things about the functional integral. And it's worth remarking that although this is I feel it's kind of typical physics thing to give these kind of ad hoc and confusing names to things. In mathematics, you would call this the derived critical locus. When h bar is zero. So that means the cohomology of this whole complex so what it computes so there's an old construction due to Serre of constructing what's called the derived intersection of two algebraic varieties. This constructs functions on the derived intersection the zero section with the graph of ds inside the cotangent bundle of B. Okay, so the classical critical locus is ds is a one form, so I take it's the image of that one form is some submanifold of the cotangent bundle. The critical locus is, where is that zero? Where does that intersect the zero section? And there's a procedure called, you know, the derived intersection, which produces for you kind of easy manifold. And this simple case, you know, this derived intersection construction is due to Serre. And it turns out to match the CV. Yeah?
In the last line, is which far formal variable or just a
here? H bar is, I want to treat it normally as a formal variable. In finite, I suppose in this context, working in finite dimensions, it's probably okay to treat it as a number. But in infinite dimensions, we should definitely treat it as a formal variable. Okay, so the BRSC complex. So this is another piece of kind of standard homological algebra, which is turned into physics, but it becomes a bit more confusing with physics. Suppose that V has an action of a leak. And which leaves S invariant. So this is the finite dimensional version of having gauge theory. And if we want to consider the integral over the quotient, so what we'd like to do is to treat this integral in a homological way similar to this. So there's going to be two steps. First one is we will treat the quotient and then we'll consider the critical locus of S outside the quotient. And more generally, when we quantize it, we'll consider the divergence, the image of the divergence with respect to the functional measure in a homological way. So this way of treating this quotient homologically is called PRC. And here, when we do both things together, we might call this PRSP slash BV or just B. But like for the mathematicians, everything will be, yeah, people who are familiar with derived algebraic geometry, this is just what you do in derived algebraic geometry. We take the derived quotient, and then we take the derived critical locus. So how do we do one? Well, whatever the quotient is, the functions on the quotient, so the quotient is like the set of g orbits, so the functions on it must be invariant under the action of g. Functions on the quotient is going to be the g invariants and functions on B. Let G be the Lie algebra of this group. So we'll choose a basis. And with some structure constants. And these guys will act by some vector fields on this manifold. So, forward. So this is a TA acts by vector fields, say F X I A E X. So these are some polynomials of the X's, so vector field polynomial coefficients. And these can must commute according to the structure constants. So when I commute these vector fields in the usual manner. So the invariance there are going to be those polynomials V of X such that zero for all A. So there, these vector fields send these functions to zero. Any questions? So the simplest case to think about is all these functions are one, with case G acts by translation. The next simplest case is all these functions are linear. In which case, the Lie algebra acts by some linear representation. It could be quadratic, in which case it might act by conformal transformations, and so on. So we want to impose this equation homologically. So there's a formula for how to do this, which was worked out by Chevalier and Eilenberg. 50, I suppose. So it's called the Lie algebra coefficient. The invariance are imposed homologically. I the Lie algebra. Good. So what's that? So this is as a vector space, it's the symmetric algebra on the dual of my vector space, and through the exterior algebra on the dual of my Lie algebra. some differential, the Chevalier-Ellmer differential. Well, so that means, so I have my original fermionic variables, my original bosonic variables, the x's from the symmetric algebra, the new fermionic variables, CA, given by the dual of the Lie algebra. These are fermionic and they're of degree one. So they have the opposite grading to the antifields. So these are the ghosts. And the Chevalier-Ellmer differential, also called the BRSP differential, although these guys did it 20 years before, is given by the formula so to impose this equation for every A, so we want to have like the kernel of this differential to be given by those B's satisfying this equation. So I want to have something like this, right? So the first term will be sum for I and A, C A, F I A, X B X I. But if you look at this, you notice that it doesn't square to zero because the commutators of this, of these vector fields, if I look at the square of this term, because these are fermionic, the square will be anti-symmetric in these indices. So there'll be anti-symmetric here, and there'll be commutators of the vector fields. Okay? And the commutators of the vector fields satisfy that equation. So they're not zero. So we need to add on another term to make square zero. And the other term is this kind of universal term, which always appears involving the Lie algebra structure constants. And it's CA, CB, E by C, half times the structure constants. Okay, makes sense. And now we can check. That this guy squares to zero. So I'm not going to go through everything, but we can just stare at a bunch of terms that will appear in the commutator. So one of the terms will be, if I square this piece, I'll get something like C A, C, B, F, A, B, C, F, I, C, E by the X, I. Call this alpha, call this term beta. This is the alpha alpha term. Now the alpha beta term will also look exactly the same. Because this guy will contract with that guy, then I'll pick up an F, A, B, C. With opposite signs. Careful about it and they'll cancel. And similarly, the beta beta term, this is going to be equal to zero by the Jacobian. In fact, the vanishing of this term is equivalent to the Jacobian. Because if you compute it, there's going to be some FF, and you want it to be totally anti-symmetric. Again, any questions about this? So for mathematicians, this may look like completely ad hoc, we're just making it up. But actually, there's a really clean homological meaning to this. So So this complex computes an ORHOMB in the category of G representations from the trivial representation to this ring of polynomials. So why is this good? Normally, maps of representations from the trivial representation to something, those are the invariant elements. But you know, if we like homological algebra, we never want to take HOMs, we don't want to take the derived HOMs. And this is one particular way of computing the derived HOMs. So that's why it's a good. And we can also write this as the X self X over the universal enveloping algebra of G of the trivial representation. Okay. So this is kind of why we should think of this as a good homological model. Let's see. So one important point we'll come to later is when we're dealing with gauge theories, this might be some huge infinite dimensional Lie algebra. It's very far from being a simple Lie algebra. So that means, you know, if we took a simple Lie group, the operation of taking invariants, that's a very nice operation because I can just integrate over the group and reject the invariants. But for an infinite dimensional Lie group, I can't do that. So that's what, so it's, there really are non-trivial derived functors in this new group, so it's important to do this. Okay, so let me, so let's explain an yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more, like how is the taking derived invariants in the Lie algebra related to taking invariants?
Yeah. So there's a map one way, but it's generally not a nice one. So if I have a compact Lie group, so if G is compact, then the functor which sends a representation to this invariant is exact. However, the Lie algebra cohomology of G with coefficients in B is equivalent to the invariant tensor, the cohomology. So just the invariant tensor, the cohomology of the group, and B doesn't matter. So in this case, they're really different. And you can see why that has to be the case, because like here we use the fact that it was compact, but the Lie algebra doesn't know about which form of the group we've taken. It could have taken a non-compact form, in which case this would not be an example. There'd be different category representations. So when we work in infinite dimensions, typically what you find is an infinite dimensional Lie algebra, which looks like jets into a finite dimension. So it's an extension of a finite dimensional simple Lie algebra by something nilpotent. If I have a nilpotent, for a nilpotent algebra, there's no difference between the Lie algebra and the group. So for all this infinite dimensional nilpotent stuff, the Lie algebra is good enough. This is the right thing to do. For the simple part, which corresponds to constant gauge transformations, we have to think a little bit about which form of the group we should take. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, so let's see how would we impose gauge invariants for a gauge theory. So as we have a game theory, on Rn, so the fundamental field is a one form on Rn. I want to take the gauge group to be U1, or R. So I'm going to impose gauge invariance at the level of operators in this homological way. So what do the operators define? So naively, find O I of A is the ith component of A evaluated at 0. In other words, I contract with the vector field. So I want to be kind of careful at this stage in distinguishing between field, which is something on a which is some continuous thing on the manifold satisfying some differential equation, and an operator, which is a function of this. This is like one of my pet peeves with terminology in physics. So you know, a long time ago, Maxwell said a field is a function on space-time. And then at some stage in the, you know, I don't know when. Like if you look at the Whiteman axioms, he uses the word field for a function of what Maxwell calls a field. And so it's super confusing. And it's, I mean, it's okay when you have a metric and you can raise and lower indices freely, but when you don't have a metric, it's they're really different.
Assuming at this stage there's no difference between
Q1 and R. Between which, sorry?
Q1 and R.
Yes, so there will be a difference. I mean, this issue we're talking about projection and invariance will play a role in a minute if you want to be very careful. OK, so how do we impose invariance? So we introduce a new field. Chi of 3 minus 1 and corresponding operator. C of chi is the evaluation of chi at 0. And this is of degree 1. So we also have, so derivatives and derivatives of these operators. So chi is going to represent gauge transformations. So d of chi is A, because A varies by gauge transformation by d of chi, because we're dealing with an abelian gauge theory. So thinking about operators, we must have the dual formulation. If I take a function of A, it varies by a function of C. RST differential applied to operator O of I is going to be, well, if I take the ith component of this guy, it's going to be the derivative in the ith direction of this field. That's going to be d at psi. Okay. So the full algebra of operators it's going to be a tensor product of a symmetric algebra on Rn joined the x1 up to the xn. So these generators correspond to the operators which measure some derivatives of one of the components of the gauge field. And I'm also going to have an exterior algebra. And these are the operators which measure some derivative of the generator of gauge constructions. And the differential is defined on the generators by E, BRC, of an arbitrary derivative of O sub I is equal to I. So I just increase the number of derivatives by one. I feel like things have got a bit confusing. How are people feeling about this?
Can you just quickly repeat why D, repeat why D by R S T of O I is D X I C?
Yeah.
I just missed that.
So, yeah, that's an important point. So O I is a functional of the gauge field, which takes its component. And this BRST differential is supposed to measure the failure of that to be gauge invariant. How does that function transform when I change my field by a gauge transformation? So if I apply a gauge transformation to that, I'm going to pick up the derivatives of the gauge transformation. So I get that term. So you can check that, for instance, you expect the gauge invariant operators to be the curvature. So what's the curvature? Going to be given by something like del xi oj minus del xj oi. These guys will give you the components of the curvature, and these should be gauge invariant. Because if I apply the BRST operator, this guy picks up the j derivative of c, this guy picks up the I derivative of c, because partial derivatives commute, zero. Yeah?
Is this complex zero down the fiber of the local observables at zero?
Yes. Yeah, but we're not imposing the equations on the machine.
Right.
But yes.
Once we do that.
Yeah. Exactly. Once we introduce the anti-fields, we'll get exactly that. Okay. Is everybody ready to move on to the final step of putting the gauge invariance and the critical locus together? Yeah, sorry, before I do that, I just want to mention one point that Eugene raised. So I said U1 or, and so far it doesn't look like there's going to be a difference. There actually is a difference. In the case of U1, we shouldn't talk about C by itself. We should only talk about the derivative of C. Let me write that up here. For a compact gate group, we do not use C, only the derivative of C. So C is what imposes gauge invariance for constant gauge transformations. And these are the things imposing gauge invariance for non-constant gauge transformations. So to do gauge invariance for the constant gauge transformations, because these form a compact group, we just project the gauge invariant operators. And then project operators. Variant. Under a compact group of constant transformations. So in mathematics, this kind of thing is called relatively algebra cohomology. It happens when you have a Lie algebra that contains a piece which is integrated to the group. And then you take actual invariance for that group and homological invariance for the rest. And like in practice, this is important. So, you know, you might want to compute there's something called the supersymmetric index or the supersymmetric theory, where you compute the space of local operators, then you look at the character of its cohomology. Now, if you use this prescription, you get the correct answer, and if you don't, you get zero. So this, it's really essential to use this. Suppose we have V, a vector space, and some function, polynomial, and an action of a group on V, and correspondingly algebra. So, when we want to model critical locus of S inside quotient. We want to do this in some homological way. So we know how to do this. So what we'll do is we'll take our homological model for the quotient and then add on extra variables of the opposite parity to form the critical locus. So before we had the quotient, we could model the critical locus by introducing an antifield for every here. And now we do the same, but including the ghosts. So here's how it works. V mod G is modeled by polynomials in the xi's and c's. So we introduce psi I, which are fermionic and degree minus one, and B sub A, if taken a string theory course are likely to be familiar with the BGOs. These are bosonic of degree minus 2. And recall that C sub A is fermionic of degree 1. So this is the antifield to this, and this is the antifield to the x's. And the sum of the degree of a field and antifield is always minus 1. We have the B, the anti-bracket, x I psi j is delta I j. And similarly, B A C B is delta A B. So what we're doing is like treating this guy as functions on some supermanifold and just imposing the critical locus function by introducing, by passing to some cotangent. So ask, what's the differential? So it must include the term which is given by the bracketing S, which is some del S del X I psi I, because this imposes the equations of the critical locus. And it also must include a term which imposes gauge invariance. Just write out the formula for the differential. And then we'll kind of think about what it means. Full differential, I'll write it as V differential, or sorry. Q is given by the BV anti-bracket with something which is a sum of two terms. The first term is S long formula, so let's ponder it for a bit. So this is the one we had before. So what's this term? Remember, the Lie algebra generators acts by the vector fields sum f I a x by the x I. And also the bracket of psi I with anything gives, well, that bracket is p by dx. So this term, once I take its bracket, will give me this differential, plus other stuff. So let's just compute what we find. So B, so the very first term we want to compute is what happens if we plug in xi? Well, xi only pairs with psi. So qxi is xca fi. This is the correct thing we want, so this imposes the eigenvariance. Q psi I. So we want Q psi I to cut out the critical locus. So we imagine putting a psi I in there. Remember that the x is pair with the size, and s is a function of x. So this will have two terms. S x I. This imposes critical locus. There'll be another term. Well, what's the other term? We know the size must themselves transform under the action of the gauge group. So the other term tells us we don't want to look at all size, just the gauge invariant operators. So the second term comes from the fact that size might pair with the f's. That extension there. Maybe plus or minus c a del x I f a x psi j. Make sense? So for example, suppose these functions f were linear. That means we had a linear action of our gauge symmetries. The size would transform in a linear representation too, the dual representation. And this thing would say Q acts on the size by some matrix. Like the dual matrix of how it acts on the x's. So this is really taking the gauge invariant functions of psi. Q A C as usual. And then there's a term involving B as well. Any questions about all this? Does it feel a bit made up?
Yeah, it's still very sense. Can you characterize that action functional as unique and satisfying some properties or not unique, but at least satisfying some?
Yes. So yeah, that's a great question. So this involves like some more abstract homological algebra. So this derived quotient, we'll view this as a DG, as a kind of DG manifold, a derived subset. Then we can look at the derived critical locus. S on this quotient, A is given by this shifted cotangent model with some differential. So forming derived quotients and derived critical locuses, these are all operations one can do in the world of DG manifolds or derived schemes. So the point is, this derived critical loci are always shifted Poisson, or indeed shifted synthetic. Shifted synthetic DG schemes or DG manifolds. So once you convince yourself of this, well, because it's symplectic, the differential must be the Hamiltonian vector field or something. The differential must be some Poisson bracket with something, and that something is the BV action. So giving yourself a differential graded shifted symplectic manifold is the same thing as giving yourself just a graded symplectic manifold with a function on it, satisfying the classical mass. So this function, this is a more geometric way to do it, and that's a more kind of formula-based way of doing it. But the invariant meaning is. Any questions about this? So I think we should do an example. So I want to do the example of one-dimensional gauged quantum mechanics, and we'll see why it produces the symplectic quotient. So I'll see how far we can get. I'm not sure this will be too long. You know what? I think this example might be a little bit too lengthy. Time remaining, so maybe I should do. Do a more standard example. Let's do the example of abelian Young null theory. Suppose if we study abelian Young null theory and we want to introduce fields, ghosts, and all of this, what we've done, what does the algebra of operators look like? So we start as before. We have field A, which is a one form. This is a degree zero, and something generating the gauge transformations. And then we need to add antifields, So there's going to be A star. This is n minus 1 form. 1, and chi star. So I've written things so that the symplectic pairing is just given by wedging and integrating. So we can ask, like, what operators do we have? Like, what local operators do we have? So there's OIA, which evaluates the ith component of A at 0. And of course, there's the derivative of that guy. And there's C, which evaluates this guy at 0. There's also functions of the antifield of A. So what will I call those? So we can index them by an n minus 1 form, or we can use Hodge star and index them by 1. I'm not going to be too careful about raising and lowering indices. And there's also E. So the homological degree of these guys are 0, 1, minus 1, minus 2. And for each operator that I listed, we also have all of its derivatives. So we can evaluate any derivative of our results. So the next thing to ask is, what is the DV operator? So this case, it's going to be very simple. So typically, if we had a non-abelian gauge theory, there would be terms which took an operator to a product of two more operators. Here, because it's an abelian gauge theory, and the kinetic term is quadratic, every term will take one of these operators to just an operator again. So the formula, if we work out what we had before, OI gets sent to del the derivative of C. Well, this NI operator, this is built from the antifield of A, so this really better impose the angles. So it's going to be given by thinking about what's the component of B star D. So what does that look like? That's the second order operator. I'm not very fast at thinking on my feet. So one term will be the Laplacian, but I can't Sorry, I'm moving it slow. You guys remember the formula? So this here to say that this describes the image of this guy will be those functions which vanish from the solution of the angle of the now we just need to figure out what B is. And it turns out that this is This we can figure out by looking at this formula. So in this formula, we're in a case where the action is by translation. We're just taking a gauge wheel and shifting it. So the f's are constant. So if we look at that formula, there's a term where c contract with a b and produce an antifield. So there's something where b gets sent to an antifield, which is what's happening here. And the reason there's derivatives is because there's derivatives, space-time derivatives in that term, because that term is related to the gauge transformations of the Abelian gauge. Okay, so I should stop and check any questions?
I'm still confused. How do you choose
GBI? Well, as I said, you can derive it from this expression. So let me maybe write that out. So the fields and antifields form this. I'll write out all the fields and antifields, then write out that action, and then you can write. And the full BV action, this guy is called pi a star chi star. So we'll just look at that expression. The first term will be the Yang-Mills action, which we'll write as a wedge b star b of a. And then the second term, there'll be no third term because it's an Abelian gauge symmetry. The second term will be that term there, which tells us about the gauge transformations. So it only depends on chi a and a star in general. But because because we only translate a, the second term only depends on chi and a star. So just integral of chi, right, like this, e chi wedge a star. So notice that if we do the symplectic pairing, a star contracts with a and produces e chi, and that's the gauge transformation. So that's how we know what this term is. Now, if I consider SBV, bracket with a linear function of chi star. Chi star, well, I'm going to be using this term. But by integration by parts, I can rewrite this as pi by dA star, and I contract that to that. So I often find it convenient to think about this complex. Where this guy does the gate transformations, the kernel of this map is equations of motion. So the cohomology here is solutions of the equations of motion modulo gate transformations. And the rest of it is kind of determined by the fact that this differential is compatible with the pairing, which pairs this and this, and this and this. so the operators are just, they live in the dual of this. So I take, you know, a function up here, I'm going to use some kind of distribution like a delta function. And here there's a delta function with some coefficient given by the one-form index. And the differential goes the other way, the dual complex. That then they need a slightly bad formula. And so next time, then, I think we'll do the example of gauged quantum mechanics. And we'll see that will lead us to the Hamiltonian formulation of BBM.